Welcome to Warships Pod. And in this episode, we have some special guests who will talk with me about Royal Navy and lethality and how to increase it. And my guests are Dr. Emma Salisbury, who is a fellow at the Council on Geostrategy, specialising in naval matters, defence-related industrial policy and military procurement. She recently completed her PhD with a dissertation focused on the history of the US military-industrial complex. She's also a senior staffer for a Member of Parliament and an assistant editor at War on the Rocks. William Freer is my other guest, and he's a research fellow in national security at the Council on Geostrategy, where his work centres around the Council's strategic advantage cell, exploring the key foreign and defence policy issues facing the UK. Before joining the Council, he did war studies at King's College London and went on to work in the world of consulting. He is also an associate fellow with the Royal Navy Strategic Studies Centre. Welcome.
Thanks for having us, Ian.
Thanks for having us.
Good to have you here. And I wonder if we could kick off things by asking a simple question. Firstly, why, in simple terms, do we need to have a more lethal Royal Navy? And would you like to start, Emma?
Sure. I think the key point is that the Royal Navy is going to have to do more in the near future. With the global situation as it is right now, we have both Russia and China to deal with, as well as non-state actors such as the Houthis in the Red Sea. So all of these problems do require some kind of naval response. So the Royal Navy is going to need to be able to respond to all three of those, plus anything else that may come up over the next 10, 20 years. So with that in mind, this is a very good time to think about what the Royal Navy needs to become more lethal and more survivable in order to be able to deal with those threats.
Yeah, I would fully echo those sentiments. And I'd also add that I think not just has the sort of threat picture changed, but also the Navy is the best tool available to the UK to deal with a more volatile world. As an island nation, you know, we're very reliant on the free movement of goods across the world's oceans, but not just that. These days, the unfettered sort of traveling of internet cables underwater and energy as well is also absolutely vital.
And one thing that does strike me, though, is the challenge that the Royal Navy and also the maritime sector in the UK faces, which is actually explaining to people what it and they do, which seems to be lost, this thing called sea blindness. So what do you think is the best way to explain the Royal Navy's role? What is the Royal Navy's role, in simple terms, would you say, today?
It's kind of mixing together the missions of defending and acting overseas. So the primary mission of the Royal Navy is to defend Britain and her territories. And also, as Will said, that includes defending our infrastructure, our data cables, our offshore energy, everything like that. And I think it's good to be able to communicate to the public that that defence is not just in the kind of traditional way that people think of, you know, from invasion or from an adversary ship doing something terrible in our waters, but also does link into our economy and people's everyday lives in terms of the things that they do every day all rely on some kind of maritime security. And then also bringing in the picture of acting overseas. So that is not just, again, to do with traditional war fighting, but also has to do with diplomatic missions, presence, and then humanitarian relief, disaster relief. So there are all sorts of different things that the Royal Navy does. I think it's very important to be able to communicate to people that although the Royal Navy is there to keep us safe, there are lots more other things that it does to help the UK.
Yeah, I would say obviously the sort of core most important task is the war fighting element and the deterrence element, which ultimately keeps us as safe as possible from state-based threats on the peer level, you know, countries like Russia and China. But that it is important that people understand the day-to-day activities of the Navy across the whole spectrum of military activity, especially in peacetime, whether that's patrolling fisheries, evacuating civilians from a country that's in a crisis, or, you know, simple diplomatic presence missions, going around visiting friends and allies and protecting British interests.
So what are the component parts of more lethality? Because obviously people might think in traditional terms like big guns, you know, powerful missiles, What are the component parts today when it comes to giving the Royal Navy that lethality? And where does it lack it at the moment, do you think? Where does it need more lethality?
So I think lethality at its core is a very simple concept. It essentially means the ability to destroy an adversary's assets, whether, you know, at sea or on land. That's always been something that naval powers had to be able to do. And it has been a long-standing criticism of the Navy that it's lacked a bit of lethality. There was, I think it was 2022, the Defence Select Committee described the Navy as porcupines, you know, very well-defended herbivores, which I think is a slightly harsh picture because they were really there looking at it mostly from the Navy's ability to strike targets on land, whereas actually with the nuclear-powered attack submarines, the Navy's always been very lethal when it comes to other naval threats. You only have to look at the Falklands War to understand that. But it is definitely a very valid criticism that it's lacked a bit of punch when it comes to striking targets on land. And in terms of what lethality is today, I think that it's not just about destroying an adversary's assets. Lethality doesn't exist in a vacuum. You know, in order to be lethal, you've got to be able to survive long enough in a high-threat environment to strike at what you want to hit. There's no point having a very heavily armed warship at the bottom of the ocean. It's no longer lethal. So I think survivability and also deployability, the ability to have the infrastructure and crews to keep a ship at sea, are also vital components of lethality.
Absolutely. It's kind of that the importance of mass and firepower to lethality are very, very central. But as Will said, it's also about being able to maintain and deploy those assets in the places that you want to for the length of time that you want to be able to do that. So that does come down to things like maintenance, logistics, crewing, and then you bring in the aspects of the fleet that aren't, you know, traditionally armed in the sense of providing that punch, but do you provide the kind of capabilities that enable the warships to do their thing? So those are things like OPVs, the Royal Fleet Auxiliary, who kind of provide the support to be able, for those warships to be able to do the punchy side of things.
It strikes me at the moment we have a major problem with the Royal Navy, which is that the submarine support infrastructure is not able to deliver submarines back into operations if they need maintenance or takes a long time doing refits. The HMS Vanguard refit being a famous example, 7.5 years, and then Audacious has been waiting or at Devonport and has had some work done like HMS Victorious has, but has yet to enter a dock. And then we have falling warship numbers because of the recruitment, the turgid recruitment process, and the Royal Fleet Auxiliary. So, Emma, you highlighted those support things, and so did you, Will. But do you think there's a few years to go before we get near having that side of it, the support side of it, the auxiliary side of it, actually properly functioning again?
I do. That is an aspect of this report that really caused me some red flags. And it's easy to overlook the RFA because people do tend to focus on the sexier side of things. So that's your missiles, your submarines, you know, all the stuff that goes boom and looks really cool. But the RFA is absolutely vitally important when it comes to actually being able to use those assets. Because if you can't supply them, you can't replenish them, then you can't use them. And particularly the solid store replenishment side of things, to have only one ship, the RFA Fort Victoria, that can replenish our aircraft carriers is very, very concerning. And although there is a program in the works to replace Fort Victoria and to build a couple more, that doesn't seem to be getting anywhere. And it's one of those things that kind of goes across quite a few programs, both in our Navy and in others' navies, that it's great to have a program in the works and to intend to do something, but unless you are actually doing it, you're going to have the possibility of a big capability gap in that period between the program being written down, put out to tender and so on, and those ships actually going into service. So I think solid store replenishment is one of the things that really jumped out to me in doing this research as somewhere that we should be very concerned.
And one of the things that I was thinking about then when you were talking was there was a mentality in the Royal Navy at the, I think in the early 2000s, I remember interviewing one particular admiral, whereby the Royal Fleet Auxiliary could do things that Royal Navy warships wouldn't do, because they would use them as platforms for, let's say, going to the West Indies or supplying aid to somewhere in West Africa. And also there was this idea that the Royal Navy might take over certain Royal Fleet Auxiliaries. But it strikes me that with the problem of attracting enough merchant navy mariners into the Royal Fleet Auxiliary and getting people into the Royal Navy system to even send out its warships as well, the fundamental has to be looking at people and then using the vessels for what they're really meant to be used for. Is that something you'd agree with?
Absolutely. I mean, a ship, any ship is just a hunk of metal without its people. And you have to be able to get the right people in to both the Royal Navy and the Royal Fleet Auxiliary, and you have to make them want to stay. So retention is also a huge deal, because it's all very well recruiting somebody, but if you don't treat them well and they leave in a couple of years, then you haven't achieved anything. So the personnel side of things is vitally important in being able to actually deploy the ships that we want to see built, that we want to see maintained, that we want to see out on the seas doing what they're supposed to be doing. And that is also an issue in sort of the land-based side of things with maintenance, as you said, with the submarine support base, and also for building ships. If you don't have the necessary skills and people to actually weld these things together, then you're also not going to have ships. So the people side of things really cuts across the entire network of support and deployment for the Royal Navy and the Royal Fleet Auxiliary. I don't know how we fix that. I hope somebody somewhere knows how to do that. But I think it's something that we really need to take a serious look at.
And Will, something else that occurred to me was that it seems, especially since 2010, there has been this inclination within the UK government seeking to save money in defence, you know, make cuts here and there, of hoping that allies will do the work. Like if you don't have a Royal Fleet Auxiliary, for example, well, the Germans will lend you one, or the Norwegians will send one, or if we don't have a certain kind of jets, then we'll get somebody else to do it. So do you think that there's certainly since SDSR been a kind of a disease of, well, we'll just get other allies to do it? Do you think that's been a problem as well?
Well, I think, yeah, there's two different factors at play there. There's one, the funding side of things, and two, the relying on allies side of things. I think actually the burden sharing with allies has long been something that the UK has done to, you know, find strategic advantage and make its own resources go further. And I think it was the 64 Defence Review that was the one that said we wouldn't ever seek to undertake, you know, major military operations on our own, building on some of the lessons of experiences from operations a few years previously, such as the Suez Crisis. And it's definitely a good thing to have allies who you can burden share with. It makes life a lot easier for everyone. And that's something that countries like Russia and China definitely suffer from, a lack of allies. But of course, it does run the risk of everyone going, oh, it's fine, we can all rely on someone else to take up the slack. And if everyone does that, then you're not really all burden sharing. So I think it definitely needs everyone to play their part, and not just when it comes to the signaling side of things, but when military action's actually required having the political will to take part. I think, you know, the Red Sea showed that in the early days, when it was a very dangerous situation, not that many people turned up to help keep the shipping lanes open. Over time, that's gotten better, but I think that was an interesting moment to see which countries were and weren't willing to send ships to the area. When it comes to the funding, yeah, defence expenditure in the UK has been, you know, steadily on the decline since the end of the Cold War, and only just has started to pick up again. And in fact, I think last year or the year before, if you looked at the Stockholm Institute SIPRI's figures, every single NATO member, apart from two, increased defence spending from 2021 to 22. It was Greece and the UK that were still reducing. Luckily, you know, that's gone up, and there were strong signals from both parties in the campaign that 2.5% would be the target figure. Is that enough? I don't think so, personally. I think 2.5, as soon as possible, aiming for 3 by the end of this decade is probably more where we need to be, considering the impact that, you know, 2 decades of underinvestment in the enabling and support infrastructure has had. You know, you're starting from a much lower level. You've got to rebuild the industrial capacity and the support infrastructure at the same time as trying to regenerate the sort of tooth element of the tail and teeth combination. So hopefully things are going to be getting better in the future. You know, allies are all starting to invest more. We're starting to invest more. I think everyone's realized that the era of the peace dividend is well and truly behind us. The fact it took us all this long to realize perhaps was a bit of a problem, but better late than never.
And Emma, do you think there's been any sense of reevaluation or even shock due to the Red Sea situation, whereby suddenly the idea that you need numbers and presence and critical mass has been rammed home in some political quarters and maybe military quarters, because, you know, we had Diamond out there for quite a long time and now we've committed Duncan. But beyond that, it looks difficult to maybe rustle up another Type 45 destroyer to do the same job. So is there any kind of urgency because of the Houthi versus the Western Navy situation in the Red Sea?
I hope so. I mean, if this kind of thing isn't going to give certain people a prod, then I'd be very worried. I think there was also quite a bit of realization that many of our smaller allied navies simply do not have the capability to be able to contribute, especially in the sort of the tooth end of things. And that's probably a bit of a wake-up call as well, that if you don't own the capability to be able to fight that kind of threat, that is a thing in itself that you need to be thinking about a lot. But then there's also, even if you have the capability, like we do, the French, the Germans, etc., you need to be able to send it, maintain it, and then resupply it, and then also cycle it out for a similar ship, as you said. So it's one of those things where they always say that necessity is the mother of invention. Crisis gives us an impetus to rethink things. But as Will said, it shouldn't really have taken this level of crisis to give people the impetus to sort this kind of thing out. So better late than never, as Will said. I'm glad that questions are being asked, things are being thought through, but I would quite like that to have been done 10 years ago.
Do you think that a major driver of the need for more lethality, in at least some respects, will be the need to counter drone swarms? And also, not that it wasn't already known as a threat, but drone swarms and also the sort of missiles being fired by the Houthis. Are we going to see more self-defense like that in Royal Navy warships, do you think?
Yeah, I think there's two elements to this. That, again, yeah, the number of hulls available is important for lethality, because you've got to have the ship in the right place at the right time, and presence matters. And without having enough escorts available, you know, your destroyers and frigates, then you'll have to face very difficult choices on what you do and don't react to in world events. And over the years, you know, the escort fleet in the Royal Navy has been allowed to creep down to dangerously low levels. You know, in 1980 we had over 70, 20 years later in 2000 we had just over 30, and another 20 years later by 2020 we had under 20. And numbers have dropped again fairly recently, but luckily it does seem that, you know, the number of escorts should grow by the end of this decade and continue to grow through the 2030s. So we're starting to get ahead of that problem, but, you know, ideally I think the pace should be happening quicker, and the goal should be even more hulls than we currently have in mind. But of course that requires not just the investment in building the ships, but having the infrastructure to be able to build them at that pace. And when it comes to the threat environment, I think the Red Sea and the Black Sea fighting shows us how the threat environment and the threat picture has changed and the new threats that are emerging. But I think people should be slightly cautious about the threat from drones. I think in the Black Sea, the Russian Navy has historically not focused on small surface craft as a major threat, whereas in Western navies, particularly the US and the UK, we've long been worried about fast attack craft from the Revolutionary Guard in the Persian Gulf. So we've tailored our warships quite well to dealing with that sort of threat from uncrewed surface vessels, USVs, with, you know, lots of layers, point defenses, helicopters with relatively cheap short-range missiles that can take these things out. Whereas the Russians, and I don't know if anyone's an expert on Russian naval doctrine, but for some reason have seemed to focus a lot more on anti-saboteur equipment for their ships, which are not very good against this threat. But even then, the Russians have started to adapt. And I think the last Russian ship that was sunk by a Ukrainian USV was February this year. So it's been 5 or 6 months. So I think it's becoming clear that the Russians are adapting. And we also saw not that long ago a Ukrainian surface drone with surface-to-air missiles bolted onto the back. So clearly Russian helicopters, I would assume, are now starting to have an impact. And again, in the Red Sea, I think we've seen the choices of Royal Navy and US Navy ship designers vindicated in the fact that, you know, nothing has been hit yet, or no warships have been hit yet. And the, you know, big bulk carriers that are slow moving are a lot more vulnerable. And even then, those that are hit tend to be hit when there's not a warship nearby to protect them. But it is important to signify that the threats are growing. You know, the Houthis are a non-state actor with some support from the Iranians, of course, as a state backer. But the fact that a group like that has been able to cause such difficulties in the maritime environment is something we need to be awake to and aware of. And I've been following the US Central Command Twitter feed. They announce every time that there's been different launches. And so far, my tally, I've been collecting the data. The Houthis have launched 310 airborne drones, 45 naval drones, 38 cruise missiles, and 134 ballistic missiles into the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. So, you know, a really significant number of weapons coming towards you. And I think that, yeah, the survivability element is just as crucial as the lethality element, because that threat picture's changed.
I mean, that's an impressive tally of stuff, no matter how relatively unsophisticated it might be compared to the high-end stuff. Those weapons are still obviously pretty lethal. But are some, Emma, are some old-fashioned ideas coming back into vogue? Are they more useful, like guns, to deal with drones rather than expensive missiles?
Absolutely. I think this is really showing that old phrase, the high-low mix. You can have these beautiful, exquisite, precision-guided missiles that cost millions of dollars a shot, and those have uses and are very good at what they do, but they cannot be used for everything, and you have to have weapon-target match. If you are attacking a quadcopter with a Claymore duct tape to it, you do not need a precision-guided missile to do that. So you have to have the availability in your arsenal of all of these range of things in order to be able to tailor your response to what is actually coming towards you. So the kind of older stuff is coming back into vogue in terms of mass and cheap mass to be able to deal with what is essentially also cheap mass coming at you from the other side. And all that really needs to happen ultimately is that you stop it from doing what it's going to do. And if you do that with a bullet, if you do that with a helicopter, if you do that with another drone, that is all good as long as it works. And I think a lot of what we're seeing now, lessons that we can learn from the Ukrainians in particular, is as long as it works, do it. You don't need to have this beautiful, exquisitely crafted system the whole time. If you can hit it out of the air or out of the water, that is the goal. If you can do that, you're good.
And the other thing that surprised me is how The Royal Navy hasn't, as far as I'm aware, used a helicopter to shoot down any drones. Is that true? I'm not being aware of that. I know other navies have. The Americans have used Harriers and, of course, Hornets. And I think other navies have used helicopters. So why has the Royal Navy not deployed its helicopter to shoot down drones, or has it?
Well, as far as I'm aware, they haven't. But I think that's probably most likely because of the threats coming in and the decisions of those, you know, at sea at the time, choosing the optimal way of dealing with the incoming threats. Looking at the, you know, what was painted on the side of the Type 45 when it came home, there wasn't a surface drone painted up there. So I'm assuming that, you know, to deal with the particular UAVs and missiles that were coming in, it was decided that the ship's missiles and guns were adequate for dealing with that. And actually, something that was perhaps the best news to come out of all this was the fact that one of the things that was shot down was a ballistic missile, which, you know, long-standing view had been that the Type 45 at best has quite a nascent ballistic missile defense capability, especially compared to, you know, American Aegis destroyers. But with recent upgrades, clearly the Type 45's got a pretty good ballistic missile capabilities and was able to shoot one down. So, yeah, I think it comes down to, you know, it better to shoot it down than try and do it in the most cost-effective way possible. But that doesn't mean that we don't need to try and be finding more cost-effective ways of dealing with the proliferation of the number of threats that are likely to be coming towards you in the future.
Okay, that's very interesting. And I suppose things will continue to evolve out there to deal with that threat, because it doesn't seem to have any end in sight at the moment. But looking at beautiful, exquisite kit, in your report, which we'll mention in our blurb for the episode podcast with links and things, in your report for the Council on Geostrategy for Lethality, you both outline the component parts of the future Royal Navy and what the mix should be. And I wonder if we could just have a quick look at what you think should be the way ahead there, whether it's for the frigates and destroyers, and also the AUKUS submarine, the future nuclear-powered submarine that's going to be built eventually by the 2040s by the UK and Australia. So what do you think the composition should be in terms of the ships, the kit of the future, and is it actually going to happen? Are we going to get, well, you mentioned more than 30, I think in the early 2000s, it's 32 frigates and destroyers. So maybe you'd like to start off with, are we actually ever going to get that full array of stuff?
Yeah, so 32 frigates and destroyers was the number that the 1998 Strategic Defence Review picked out as the ideal number of escorts for Britain's interests. And I think it's very obvious to us all now that that was a much more benign environment that 32 were deemed necessary. And yes, warships have gotten more sophisticated and better, but they've obviously got them more expensive as well, so hull numbers have come down. But I think we are starting to see a shift in philosophies, not just in the UK, but also in the US and Australia, of having a high-low mix, or a tier one, tier two fleet, as some often call it, where you have your very exquisite platforms like your Type 45s or your Arleigh Burkes, but you also have a mix of slightly less expensive, less capable hulls to pad out the numbers, to make sure that you've got that dispersal element, that survivability element, and crucially the presence element too. And I think the Type 31 program is an excellent way forward for helping deal with some of the Navy's problems. And, you know, another change with the Type 31 program that happened midway through was a decision was made to change the armament from 8 cells of the common anti-air missile, which is enough to see you out of a hairy situation if you're lucky, to 32 Mark 41 vertical launch cells, which is a huge, huge uplift in capability, and not just in the number of missiles you can carry on board, but the type of missiles you can carry. So I think that is the way forward, especially for getting more holes in the water, which is something that we all, you know, the UK, US, Australia are in desperate need of. Will we get towards 32 holes? I don't think so in the near future. I think with Type 31s and 26s on the way, and potentially the Type 32 program, although I guess we'll have to wait and see what the upcoming Strategic Defence Review says about that, we could be looking at, you know, the mid-20s for the number of holes available. Would I like to see more than that? Yes, but that then requires very difficult choices in, well, what are you cutting to help pay for this? Because even with the 2.5-3% of GDP budget, there's still going to have to be very difficult choices about where priorities lie for the UK. And I think given that a lot of our allies are very land-centric, you know, Poland's just built two new armoured divisions while we're debating how we can put another armoured brigade in the field. Finland and Sweden have just joined NATO. And although Russia's, you know, I wouldn't say on a war footing, 10% of GDP or whatever it is they're spending on defence isn't exactly all-out total war, but they're certainly on more of a war footing than us. But the amount of equipment that they've lost in Ukraine, you know, over 3,000 or 4,000 tanks, this is not easily replaceable. And on the land, I just don't think that's where the UK can bring the most value, even with a sort of NATO first outlook on things. I think the maritime environment is certainly where we should be looking to lean into our strengths for our own interests and for what we can contribute to allies. So I think things will start to get better, but hopefully we'll prioritize maritime more. But until the Strategic Defence Review comes out, there's nothing we can really predict in the future other than making the best case for the Navy that we can.
Emma, do you think we're going to see actually a pruning back of Type 26s or potential for like the Type 32? Do you think, what's your assessment of the new government? Do you think that it could do what the previous Labour administration did and it cut the Type 45s from, what, 12 to 8 to 6? Are you sensing any fears of that or any likelihood of that?
It's really, really hard to tell. Given the lack of specificity so far in what the new defence ministerial team have said, understandably, it's very, very difficult to kind of read the tea leaves and see what they might want to do in terms of the balance between the services. Obviously, the Navy is not the only service that has had cut budgets, that has had less kit, that has had fewer personnel. So there is going to be, as always, an intra-service balance between how we think about our land power, our air power, and our sea power. But as Will said, sea power is where Britain shines. And I do think that this is something the new government should recognise and should make its decisions accordingly. In terms of our report, obviously this is a vision of what the Royal Navy could look like in ideal conditions. We're not expecting that the new Labour government will just say, gosh, how fantastic, tick, 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 we'll buy everything, much as that would be very much appreciated. But it's good to have something to aim for. And as long as we're moving in the right direction on all of these capabilities, if there's more funding, more investment, and a recognition that this is the direction we need to be going in, I think we will feel successful.
One of the things that I think always puzzles people who are not deeply into this subject like we are is when we mention, let's say, 32 frigates and destroyers, people, let's say certain people who are in the land forces, because I've heard people tell me stories about their naval officers tell me stories about their meetings with army officers who didn't get this fact. And also maybe politicians don't understand that 32 does not mean 32 you have available all the time. The 32 is probably what, 10, 9, or, you know, one First Sea Lord said to me that actually you need 4 ships for every task. And I know the Navy has changed its way of doing things, keeping ships on station. But maybe you could start this off, Emma. Do you think there's a problem with perception in when the Navy's saying, oh, we want 32 frigates and destroyers? Some people say, well, that's a bit greedy. But in fact, that's the number you need to do the minimum amount of jobs for the UK around the world.
Absolutely. I think that is a fact that a lot of people don't appreciate. It's a very different method of operation with naval craft because you do have this need to have the deployment schedule take into account. Firstly, your personnel changeover, because you can't have your crew out for a stupid length of time for their own sanity and for their operational readiness. But then you also need to take into account the readiness of the craft itself. So to have that maintenance schedule, then the training and so on. And I don't think that those, as you say, who aren't naval nerds like us, tend to appreciate that you do need three or four ships to one to be able to keep that capability going. I wonder whether that's a point on which the Navy could better communicate to others. Because although we all know this internally and we all know this in this field, I think it's the kind of point that needs to be more widely known. And it's very difficult for military services to communicate with the non-military. But to be able to make the case for your own service, I think you need to be able to tell that story better. And although this does seem like the dreaded demon arts of PR, it is important because these are political decisions being made by civilians, and they need to have the facts in front of them to be able to make those decisions in an informed way.
And Will, do you think there's a battle on to just make people understand when talking about these subjects, that the Navy needs this stuff just to be able to keep pace?
Yeah, I think there is. And Ash, I'd like to bring up another point about something else that often escapes people about something that's specific to naval power, is that you really do need this long-term planning picture. It takes a long time to generate naval forces from scratch if you need them in a hurry. It basically can't be done quickly. You need a long-term plan, a long-term picture. If the threat environment suddenly changes and you haven't got ships available, you're in trouble. Whereas with land power, as we've seen in the fighting in Ukraine, it's not ideal, but if you really have to suddenly, you know, constitute brigade after brigade after brigade of forces, it is a lot easier to do that for land power than it is for naval power. And I think, bring it back to, you know, the 2010 defense review and some of the decisions made back then, that was something that really cost Britain's naval power, was the lack of long-term planning. I think 2013 was when the final Type 45 entered service, and the first Type, either 31 or 26, I can't remember which one's going to be commissioned first, will be 2026. That's a 13-year gap between, you know, our last escort being commissioned and our next one being commissioned. Whereas in that time, well, actually just from 2013 to today, you know, the Australians have managed to commission several escorts. Japan's commissioned, I think, 13 in that time, roughly one a year. The French have commissioned 8 destroyers and frigates in that time. And most concerningly of all, China's commissioned 58 cruisers, destroyers and frigates in that 10-year window since 2013. So I think that long-term planning piece is another thing that we need to be perhaps better at communicating, not just to the public, but to politicians. But luckily, it seems that there is a much more healthier pipeline of shipbuilding in the works. There's plenty being built that should enter service at the end of this decade and the start of next decade. And now, actually, the problem previously was not having enough ship orders to fill the shipyards. And now the problem is not having enough shipyards to build all the ships we want to be building, which is a better problem to have, but still a problem that we need to be working on.
Yeah, I mean, thinking of the 2010 Strategic Defence and Security Review, the new broom sweeping clean when the Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition came in, and seemed to be hating the carriers and determined to do something about the carriers and change all that, and really wanting to make deep cuts in the Navy to save money. And I just wonder, or fear, there might be some surprises there, because back in the days when we got to interview the First Sea Lords fairly regularly for the magazine, I had an interview with Mark Stanhope in London, and he talked how talked about how confident he was in the Navy making a really good case. And this was just, you know, months or weeks before it was revealed that, you know, 5,000 people would go, all the Type 22s, the carriers would go early, and the Harriers, you know, would go as well. And so, speaking quietly, fighting in the corridors of power, stating that you have a good case is great. And I do worry that the current Defence Review might see another surprise, except this time it won't be the RAF pulling off the saving of the Tornado Force. It could be the Army, you know, and pushing really hard to get a great uplift. So I wonder, do either of you have any sneaking fears of what's going to happen with the Defence Review, or the fact that Lord Robertson is at the helm and he did preside over a good Defence Review in the late 90s when the last Labour government took power, and is a former head of NATO. Does that fill you full of confidence, Emma?
It does, actually. I think Lord Robertson is a really, really good choice for this. He knows his stuff. As you say, he's got a lot of experience both in the UK sense and in the NATO sense. And given how vital NATO is going to be to us, well, it is now, but even more vital over the next 10, 20 years, I think he's got the exact combination of experience that is needed to be able to get the full picture of what Britain needs to be able to do militarily. Given that he also was instrumental in us having carriers in the first place, that gives me a little tweak of hope for the Navy side. So I think quite a lot of us naval-minded academics will be shouting very loudly at the fine folk on the Defence Review to make our case for the Navy side and try not to be drowned out by the Army.
Yeah, well done. Yeah, do shout loudly for the silent service. But Will, are you not harbouring any misgivings about a sudden twist at the end of the story when the review result is revealed?
Well, I think, you know, going into any Defence Review, you never really know what's going to come out the other side. But as Emma said, I'm quietly confident that with someone like Lord Robertson at the helm, it should hopefully be a very, very good Defence Review as a sort of whole picture exercise. It's just a shame that his 98 Defence Review was never quite fully enacted back when it was designed. And one thing I would also bring up is that when we were writing our report, you know, everyone brought it back to tasking, you know, how many ships do you need and what for and what are they going to be doing? And this is, you know, obviously a very important element in force design. But I think that oftentimes, and I don't know about other countries, but I think the UK has sometimes been guilty of having too specific a tasking. I think if you look historically at previous defence reviews, they've often assumed that, you know, global events are going one way and things suddenly appear out of nowhere. You know, no government can see the future. So I think slightly more broad tasking perhaps is something that could be beneficial, because, you know, the 1981 Knott Review thought that all we needed was an anti-submarine warfare force for the high north, and then several months later the Argentines invade the Falklands and we suddenly need to scramble together an amphibious task force that if the war had happened a year later we probably wouldn't have had available. The 2010 Defence Review suggested that it foresaw no need for fixed-wing carrier aviation likely in the future. Several months later, we're conducting air operations off the coast of Libya. So I think that if you get too granular in the tasking, that can come back to bite you. So it's good to have a broader array of what you expect your armed forces to be doing. And I think that that's something that the 98 Defence Review was very good at. It understood that it can't necessarily predict what's going to happen. So let's try and give ourselves the best options available for what might occur. And yes, there's, you know, a few obvious things out there like the Russian threat and the Houthi threat. But I think that hopefully with Lord Robertson at the helm again, we'll get that slightly broader view of things.
Brilliant. And that's a really good discussion we've just had. And fascinating stuff. And thank you very much for your insight. I wonder if we could just conclude with a final thought from both of you on the lethality of the Royal Navy. And are we going to see a more lethal Royal Navy?
I'm very hopeful that the Defence Review will do its part for the Navy. I think people are recognising that the threat picture that the UK faces requires strong naval power. And I know that all of us will be doing our best to argue the Navy's case in the corridors of power. But I think the Navy has a strong case of its own, even without us shouting for it. Maritime power is what Britain does best, and I really hope that we'll be able to keep doing it.
Yeah, I'd say that we're already moving in the right direction. You know, more vertical launch cells for the Type 45s on the way, more for the Type 31s when they enter service. New weapon systems coming in, new missiles and upgrades to the missiles. The Dragonfire laser system, hopefully towards the end of this decade, should come in. So we're already moving in the right direction. It's just that we need to be picking up the pace a bit more.
Thanks for that discussion. That was really good. And also the summary you've just given. And I can highly recommend the report that you both wrote for the Council of Geostrategy on improving the Royal Navy's lethality. And as I said, we'll put a link in the blurb so people can go and take a look themselves. So thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
For more Warships IFR, you can visit our website at warshipsifr.com. Connect with us via social media on X and Facebook. And in both cases, that's at Warships IFR. And you can also find us on YouTube at Warships IFR TV. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your podcast app. Keep your eye on the horizon for our next episode.